All right, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the review session for the Wills and Trusts midterm. Let us start first by looking at the agenda of what we're going to do this afternoon. We're going to start off with a review of intestate succession. Then we're going to do some sample intestacy questions. Then we'll start our review of wills. And somewhere in there or so, when it gets about halfway through, we'll take a 10-minute break. During the 10-minute break, you can continue to pick up snacks that Margaret brought for you, as well as sign up for door prizes if you already haven't done so. Then, after the break, we will do door prizes. Must be present to win. And then we will continue with our review of wills, as well as doing some sample pre-termitted children questions, as well as a full-length essay question. By the way, I know I didn't mention in class already, but just yesterday I finished writing your exam. There are two equally weighted essay questions, each worth 50 points, 3 pages for handwriters, 750 words each for people using their computer. With that in mind, let us start from the beginning. Now, the one thing you need to keep in mind is that our purpose today is not really to review every legal point that we made during the class. We would need like 20 hours to do that. Our purpose here is to put the material into an analytical framework, which is going to be somewhat different from the teaching order that we did things. That makes sense? That the way you would teach something, the pedagogical order, can be very different from the order you use in analyzing a question. So that's what we're doing now. How do you analyze the question? The first thing you start off with is to ascertain what law applies. Because we know that if personal property is involved, we learn and have to look at the law of the intestate's domicile at death, and that it doesn't matter where the property is actually located. On the other hand, if it is real property, we use the law of the situs of the real property. So that is the law that will determine the validity of the will, the heirs by intestacy. So you have to ascertain what state's law is applicable. Once you have ascertained that, with regard to an intestate distribution, the next step you should take is to figure out if there are any particular facts in the case that might cause us to deviate from a normal distribution scheme. So what you're doing is looking in the fact pattern for these things which might trigger something different for us to look at. For example, half-blooded collateral heirs, because in a few states, and of course one of which being Texas, half-bloods are treated differently. In Texas, half-bloods only receive each half as much as each full-blood. One of the most common errors that comes up on exams is people apply the half-blooded rules when they're talking about somebody's descendants. That when somebody dies, some of the descendants aren't related to each other as full blood. That doesn't matter. Everybody's child is only half related to them and half related to the other parent. Half and whole blood is only relevant when property is being inherited from and to collateral relatives, from a deceased sibling to other siblings, for example. Next, adopted individuals. You have to figure out, do they inherit from and through the adoptive parents? And also, do they inherit from and through the biological parents? We learned that in Texas, they inherit from all four of them, but they will not inherit from a biological parent if they were adopted as an adult. And then when the adopted individual dies, it is only adoptive and not the biological family that will take. You also know to look for the possibility that we have an adoption by estoppel, sort of a common law adoption as opposed to a legal one. Next, look for non-marital children. And we know that in Texas there is a difference in the quantum of proof needed for a non-marital child to inherit from a mother and from a father. To inherit from a mother, no additional evidence is needed. But to inherit from a father, you either need a presumption of paternity, like being married when the child was born, a court judgment of paternity, the father executing a statement of paternity, or even a post-death determination of paternity by clear and convincing evidence, typically DNA evidence. This little thing here is not what I call most effective. All right. The next thing you want to look for, aren't children. Not one with great talents, but instead children as the result of alternative reproduction technologies and whether they do or do not fit into the distribution scheme. We learned that if the heir murders the intestate, we do not have a slayer statute, as many states do, and instead we must rely on a constructive trust theory to keep the murdering heir or murdering will beneficiary from inheriting. We know that Texas has a survival period of 120 hours. That's what most states have, a period like that, but there are still some states that do not. But for us, an heir or beneficiary of a will must outlive by 120 hours. If they do not, they are treated as if they died first, and the property just passes as if they had predeceased. Advancements. When a intestate gives an heir part of the inheritance early, we learn that that does require a writing. In other words, either the advancer must say it's an advancement at the time of the advancement, or we need the heir who receives the advancement to acknowledge it as an advancement. Oral statements that a gift is an advancement will not work. Then we looked at disclaimers. We looked at disclaimers next, and that if you disclaim within 9 months of death, you are treated as predeceasing, and the property that you would have received instead passes as if you died first. So in an intestate situation, they just assume you died before the intestate, or in a will situation, they assume you died first, and then you follow the instructions of the will to determine what happens. The fact that an heir is a non-resident or non-citizen of the United States, that is an irrelevant fact, although in some times in our history, it was important. And then we have the posthumous heir, a child born after the intestate's death. If it's a lineal descendant, the posthumous heir can inherit. But if it is a non-lineal descendant, such as a niece or nephew, that person does not inherit. This becomes a big issue typically now with alternative reproduction technology children. Some states put a time limit on the posthumous children. We do not in Texas yet, but something like that may be coming up in the next session of the legislature. All right, so now we've determined the applicable law, and we've determined if we have located any facts in the scenario that would require us to use any type of different rules. So that means it is now time to begin the actual intestate distribution. We need to ascertain first whether the decedent was married at the time of death. If the decedent was not married at the time of death, then the property is individual property, and we follow the individual property distribution scheme. But if the intestate was married at the time of death, then we have to distribute community property and separate property. And those are distributed differently. And then within the separate property scheme, separate real and separate personal property may be treated differently under certain circumstances. So let us first assume that the person was married at the time of death. If there are no surviving descendants, then all the community goes to the surviving spouse, which means the surviving spouse already owned half of the community, and now the surviving spouse inherits the deceased spouse's half. That's what happens if there are no surviving children or grandchildren. Now, if there is at least one surviving descendant, we then need to ascertain whether all of the deceased spouse's descendants are also descendants of the surviving spouse. If there are only marital descendants, meaning all of the deceased spouse's descendants are also descendants of the surviving spouse, then the surviving spouse inherits the deceased spouse's half of community, which then would result in the surviving spouse owning all the community property. But if there is at least one non-marital descendant, then the surviving spouse inherits none of the community. The surviving spouse, of course, still retains the surviving spouse's half of community, but the deceased spouse's half of the community is divided among the deceased spouse's descendants. Next, what if there, I think that's the end of community, and now we move to separate property. Now, with separate property, as I mentioned before, real and personal property may be treated differently. So let's start first if there's at least one surviving descendant. At least one surviving descendant. If there's at least one surviving descendant, then with personal property, the surviving spouse inherits one-third, the other two-thirds is distributed among the descendants. With regard to real property, the surviving spouse's proportion is the same. It is still one-third, based on the old dower principle. But that one-third now is only, bless you, that one-third now is only a life estate. That means that the descendants will inherit two-thirds of the separate real outright immediately, and then they will divide the remainder interest in that surviving spouse's life estate. Now, what if there are no surviving descendants? If there are no surviving descendants, it's a little easier. The personal property now goes all to the surviving spouse. The personal property now goes all to the surviving spouse, and the real property is divided. The surviving spouse gets half. This half is outright, not a life estate. There's no descendants, no bloodline to keep it in. Then the surviving spouse gets one half, and the other half goes back to the bloodline, goes back to the deceased spouse's parents, siblings, and their descendants. But if there aren't any parents or their descendants, then it goes to the surviving spouse, rather than going up to grandparents and down to aunts, uncles, and cousins. So that takes care of both community and separate property for a married intestate. Now let's assume that the intestate was single. If the intestate was unmarried at time of death, we first would give property to the descendants, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, etc. They inherit all. If there are none of them and both parents are alive, each parent gets one half. If there's only one parent alive, the surviving parent gets half, and the half that would have gone to the deceased parent goes to the brothers, sisters, and their descendants. But if you have no siblings, for example, you are an only child, then everything would go to the surviving parent. And if by chance you have no descendants and no surviving parents, then everything passes to your siblings and their descendants. But if you don't have any of them, no descendants, no parents, no brothers, sisters, nieces, or nephews, the estate is divided into two halves. We use the old-fashioned term moiety to describe the half, with one half going to your paternal grandparents and one half to your maternal grandparents. So if all four of them were still alive, each would get a quarter. But if some of them are deceased, the property just continues down in the two sides of the family using the same distribution arrangement that we have described. And we just keep going on and on and up to great-great-grandparents and down and look for heirs forever. But if by chance we cannot find any heirs at all, then it will escheat to the state of Texas. Another issue of tremendous importance is how to handle the type of distribution when you have multiple levels of people taking at the same time. This could be children and grandchildren, brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, uncles and aunts and cousins, cousins and second cousins. It's situations where you have more than one level of descendant taking because some have died first and some haven't. There are three main schemes that are used. The first scheme, per stirpes, is from common law, but it is unlikely that any jurisdiction still uses it. I can't swear to you that no jurisdiction does, but none come to mind. That is where you always divide into shares at the first generation below the intestate, even if no one from that generation is still alive. The majority view in the United States is per capita with representation. It is also the Texas approach, and we divide into shares at the first generation that has at least one surviving member. The more modern view from the Uniform Probate Code, and one that is gaining in popularity among the states, is per capita at each generation. We still divide into shares at the first generation with survivors, but then we pool the shares of the deceased members and divide that in a per capita equal basis among all the people who are related the same, with the goal being with that approach to give everybody who is equally related to the descendant, to the intestate, the same amount. So every child would get the same and every grandchild would get the same. So that then concludes our review of the basic intestacy principles. But like anything else, the best way to be proficient with intestacy is to work through problems. And so that's what we're going to do now. We're going to work through a group of problems. Here is the first one. We have a mother and father. They have two children, C and B. C is married to H, and C has now died. We will be assuming for this, for our examples now, that we are using Texas law. That means we have to look at C, who has died, and the first question we ask is, was C married? And the answer is, yes, C was married. So that means we have the potential of community and separate property to distribute. Let's take a look first at community property. What would we do with the community property? Who receives it? Right. H, the husband, receives all of it because there are no descendants. Therefore, H keeps half and inherits half. Now, we need to handle the separate property. We know that separate real and separate personal property are handled differently. Let's start first with separate personal. Where would the separate personal go? What'd you say? Right? Would get all of it, right? The husband here would get all separate personal property. Asked to explain, what would be the reason? Why? Sorry? Why?
Because that's her husband.
Yeah, but why? Okay, what you want to do, remember, on an essay, if you give the correct answer, that's a C, maybe. You got to explain it. If you do not explain the reason for it, I just think you're guessing. There's no descendants. That's all it takes. That's the difference between a C and an A. Okay, that's all you got to do. That's analysis. That's awful short, isn't it? Is it very primitive? Is it full credit? Yes, that's all that's needed. What else is there to say? Because there's no descendants, and that's what Texas law says. I mean, but you have to be sure on the essay to give a reason. Now, on the objective, when I ask you the shares, you don't need any reason at all. Just give the amount. But on the essay, you would need to explain why. All right. With regard to separate real, what do we do there? What happens to separate real?
Half of it goes to the husband.
Correct. Half the husband. Right, meaning each of mom and dad get how much each? Right, mom and dad each get one quarter of the separate real. The surviving spouse gets the other half of the separate real. Again, the reason is there's no descendants. And so that's how we know that it goes in that manner. So that's example number one. Anybody have any questions? Seeing none, we'll move on then to number two. Now in our next scenario, we have a husband and wife that are married. They have two children. So we know again, we start off ascertaining that they are married. And that means we have separate and community to distribute. Let's start with community first. Who would you say gets the community? What would you say?
Husband.
Why?
Because.
Okay, so now you've got a C. You've right. told me the husband gets all the community. How do you get an A?
Because both children are from their union.
Both children are from their
both
union.
Both children are a result of their marriage. There are no
that's a B. Because I can come up with a fact pattern where that wouldn't handle it. That's sort of right here. How would you fix that B answer, turn it into an A answer? Yes?
Because there is a perception that the surviving spouse will take care of the children.
That is the policy behind it, which is excellent, but not the legal reason. It is because all of the deceased spouse's descendants are also the descendants of the surviving spouse. Now, I know what you said you think is close, but there could be another descendant out there. So the fact that A and B are their kids, that doesn't totally answer the question, because what if there was another child? And I want you to think, what if C had another child? Would that matter? Everybody pay attention to that, right? C has another child. Do we care?
Yes.
H has another child. Do we care?
No.
Right. It would be important if C had another child, because then... you okay?
Yep.
Okay. That not all... I know this is exciting stuff. Okay. That not all of C's descendants would be H's descendants if C had another child. But if H had another child, there are 10 of them. It doesn't matter. Because still, all of C's descendants are also descendants of H. So does that make sense? Everybody follow that? It's okay if H has other kids. He still gets all the community. But if C has another kid, then H wouldn't. All right. Let's take a look now at separate property, separate personal. What do you think about that?
One-third of the separate personal would go to the husband.
Right. And the rest of it?
Would go to the descendants, the two-thirds.
Meaning each one gets?
A third.
Very good. And the reason for that is?
Because I guess in this case there's descendants.
That's about all there is to say. Yeah, I mean, I know the analysis is simple, but that's the reason. Because there are descendants, and our statute says the surviving spouse gets one-third of the separate personal, the other two-thirds goes to the descendants. Math is nice and easy here. You got two-thirds to go in two pieces. So that just means simply one-third each. Now, what about the separate real? Now remember, the math that you use for separate personal is always going to be the same as the math for the outright interest of the separate real. So we know the surviving spouse is going to get what? Right, a life estate in one-third. Be sure not to say it, a one-third life estate. That would be incorrect. Because if you say a one-third life estate, I'm going to ask you who has the other two-thirds of the life estate. The surviving spouse has a full, an entire, a one life estate in a piece of property one-third the size of all the deceased spouse's separate real. All right. As far as outright shares, A would have how much outright of the separate real? One-third. B would have one-third. But we're not done with our distribution, are we? We still have to distribute the remainder interest. And how do we do that? How many remainders are there? One. How many people are getting them?
Two.
So each one gets how much of the remainder? One half. Right. So each of A and B have one half of the remainder interest. Questions? Comments? Seeing none, let's take a look at example number three. Now in this situation, we have the husband and wife who are married with the two kids. But now we have the example we mentioned a moment ago where there would be a difference because C, in this example, does have a child that is not a descendant of the surviving spouse. Again, because they're married, we have community and separate property to look at. What does the husband have with regard to the community property? Does he inherit anything?
Yes.
I think I misspoke. I meant to ask you community. Did I say separate? Didn't mean separate. Community. What does H inherit from the community property? I'm asking you, how much, now think carefully, how much of C's community property does H inherit? Right. Absolutely none. Why?
Because there's at least one non-marital.
Correct. Because there's at least one non-marital descendant. So in this case, H is not an heir of the community property of C at all. H, does H lose all the community? He don't use the word get. Get, if you get something, that means it's something you did not have before. Right. Be very careful, right? The term get means that you are receiving something you didn't have before. You get the flu. It's something you did not have before. But all you're doing is retaining. So all H is doing in that case is retaining his half, and he cannot inherit the other half because of P being there, a non-marital descendant. So how do we distribute the community then? What do you think?
A, B, and T.
Right.
Half, the other half, C's half.
Correct. So how much do they get? They get a sixth of the whole community property, or they each get one third of hers. So you can say it either way. I try on the exam to use dollar figures, so no matter how you compute it, it comes out the same. But on an exam, if you were doing fractions, I would not care which way you said it. You see, there's two ways you could correctly say this. You could say that P, A, and B each get either one-sixth of the entire community, or they get one-third of C's half. Either way you state it on the exam would be equally good. All right. Now let's take a look at the separate property, starting with separate personal. You looked up at me. That was a bad move.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I believe the husband gets a third of the separate.
Correct.
Personal. And then I believe P, A, and B will split the rest into two-thirds.
Correct.
Each receiving two-nines.
Perfect. Do you all see how that was done? The surviving spouse gets one-third of the separate personal. Again, because there are descendants, the other two-thirds goes to the descendants. At this point, it matters none who the other parent is. They're all equally related to C. They are all her children. And so they each get one. They are going to share one-third of the two-thirds, which would lead us to two-ninths. So they each will get two-ninths separate personal. We know with regard to real that the outright shares are always the same. So they're going to get two-ninths of the separate real as well. So they always get outright two-ninths. In this situation, they get the same amount of personal as well as outright real. Surviving spouse again has what? A life estate in one-third for the same reason as in the last problem. But we now have to distribute the remainder. And how would we distribute that remainder? Louder?
Divided by three,
which means each of P, A, and B get one-third. So they each get one-third of the remainder interest. Nicely done. Anybody have any questions? Yes?
When we're describing like the one-sixth, the one, like one-third, one-sixth, CP, we just say, instead of saying like the wife's half, we just say the wife's community property?
Yes.
That'd be correct.
Yeah, because the wife's community property is one-half of the community property. Like I said, that's why on the exam I tried to use dollar figures, because then no matter what logic you use, the dollar amount has to come out the same. Sure. But no, it does not matter how you say it if it's right. Any questions? All right, let's take a look now at question number four. Number four. As you can see, they're getting a little more complicated now. Now, when you look at a problem like that, you should immediately be able to see the main thing I'm trying to test. What would you say the main reason that problem would be there? Right. To see how you handle multiple generation taking, because the rest of the problem is the same like all the others. So with regard to the community property, we know that H gets her half and keeps his half and now has how much of the community? All of it. And you know, again, the reason is all of C's descendants are also descendants of H. So that's the same as the more simple problem, or the simpler problem, that we went over earlier. Now, with regard, so we know the community all goes to H because all of C's descendants are also H's descendants. We now need to divide the separate personal property. We know, again, the surviving spouse gets one-third of the separate personal property. The other two-thirds goes to the children and the grandchildren here. And we need to ascertain how that would be divided. At this point, you know, you need to know the appropriate scheme used to do multiple generation distribution. Because you can look at that and hopefully see that per capita with representation like Texas would handle it one way, and per capita at each generation would another, because at each generation would pool the shares of R, S, and T and divide them equally, whereas per capita with representation would simply give A's share to R and divide B's share between S and T. Since I told you for this problem to assume that we were doing Texas law, let's look at it that way. How much would R get of the separate personal, which is the same as, of course, the outright share of separate real? Anybody care to volunteer? I'm up here. Don't be afraid. Yes?
1/6.
1/6. Can you tell me how you got that?
Yeah, so the husband got 1/2 and then...
No. Oh. Husband got...
Oh, 1/3.
1/3?
And then the other 2/3 are split between A, B, and C. A, B, C, and D first, which is 4.
Correct.
So that's...
2/3 times 1/4 is...
2/12.
2/12 reduces to 1/6. A only has one descendant, R, so R gets? Very good. S and T would each get? 1/12, dividing B's 1/6 in half, and each of the surviving children get? 1/6, because they're a surviving child. Nicely done. Anybody have any questions with this problem?
Do you care whether we say 2/12 or 1/6?
Nope. Whatever way works for you will be fine. That is an accurate answer. This is not math class where I will say you only get credit if you reduce them to their lowest common form. Not necessary. Either way is fine. So a question over here. Yes?
Can you explain the first herpes again? How that would happen?
How it would happen?
How would you separate it in that way?
If it was first herpes? Now, under the fact pattern here, there would be no difference between per stirpes, a strict per stirpes, and per capita with representation. Because per stirpes divides at the first generation, which is children, and per capita with representation divides at the first generation with survivors. So there would be no difference in our distribution between per capita and per stirpes and per capita with representation. There would be no difference. The only difference would be if you had a per capita at each generation, where we would take the shares of A and B, because A and B were each going to get 1/6. So we would take their 2/6 and we would divide them equally into 3 pieces. Right, that's what per capita at each generation would do, which then ends up with each one getting 1/9 would be what each would get if you were doing it per capita each generation. Yes?
What would be our
The whole analysis for that is that you are following a per capita with representation distribution scheme where you divide it the first generation with survivors. From there on out, it's just math. Show your work. I can give partial credit if all I determine is you made a slight math error as opposed to not knowing what the rule is. Anything else? Good questions. All right. Let's take a look at our next problem. Now, when you take a look at this one, you should immediately be able to detect the concept being tested before we start. What is the main purpose of this question? Half and whole blood, right? Because we have a sibling who has died without descendants and without both parents alive, and so it's going to his siblings, and so we know we have half and whole blood issues to worry about. So in this situation, mother and father had three children, but father had a child from another relationship. Father has predeceased, and now C has died. C is unmarried, has no kids. So what do we do with C's property? What would be the first thing we would do as far as giving property to the parents, since that's the easiest one? What would you do?
Sorry, ask the question again.
How much would you give to M?
M gets one half.
Gets one half because the property goes equally to parents, or if only one parent, then the surviving parent gets half.
That's right.
Okay, now, in many states, we wouldn't say that. In many states, we would just give M everything. In a lot of states, a surviving parent gets all the property. That's not the way it works here. If one parent is dead, the other half goes to your siblings. But in our case, some siblings are whole, some siblings are half. Now again, in the vast majority of states, they wouldn't care. They would look at that and give one-third to each one. They'd say, oh, three siblings, they each get a third of the half, so they each get one-sixth, we're out of here. That's what most states do. We don't. We still retain the Scottish rule with regard to half and whole blood, where every half must get half as much as every whole. So would anybody care to try to do the math here and tell us how much S1, S2, and H receives? Anybody, come on. Be brave. Yes.
Since the whole-blooded shares get twice as much, you compute two shares for each of them.
Right.
And so S1 gets two shares, S2 gets two shares, and then the half-blood only gets one share. So that's a total of five shares. And then you're multiplying that by the half that they're all entitled to get, I believe, one-tenth.
Correct. Now, did you all follow that? We count two shares for every whole, one share for every half. That gives us five shares. But those five shares are only in half the property because we already gave half the property to the surviving parent. So instead of being fifths, they have to be tenths. So what does S1 get?
S1 would get two tenths.
Right, two of the shares as a whole.
Which reduces to one fifth.
Correct.
S2 would get the same with S1.
Right.
And then the half blood would get one tenth, which would half as much as one fifth.
Exactly. And you can check your work by saying if H gets one tenth, that's one. S got two tenths, add that together, that's three. S1 got two tenths, that's five. Five tenths is one half. And then you gave the other half to M, and you come up with one. And if your math comes out to one, the odds are either you did it right or you made lots of mistakes because they had to counteract each other. Nicely done. Thank you. Anybody have any questions on this half and whole-blooded question? Questions, comments? Does anybody now, let's take a few minutes, have any intestacy questions? Because that's sort of the end now of our intestacy discussion. Anybody have any intestate succession questions that they want to talk about? Yes?
The last question.
This one? Yeah?
When we did the real property, can you go over what the remainders are for the... So
we have one remainder.
Right. So is it one-fourth to R, C, and D?
Yes.
One-eighth to S and T?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to clarify.
That's perfect. If you understand why you did it, you're in great shape.
All right.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
For this problem, too, I know you told us that per capita representation. Is there any way you could go through per capita at each generation? Because I got a different the way the shares split up.
Okay, if you were doing this in per capita with representation, the first thing you would do is you would pool the shares that A and B were going to get. So let's look at the outright shares. We know that each of them were supposed to get, how much would A have gotten if he had lived? No, because remember we already gave one third. Right. Okay, and B would have gotten? That's 2/6, right? So now we'd have to take those 2/6 and divide it equally in three pieces. Okay, so let's do the remainder interest, which is much easier. So how would we do the remainder interest? How would you figure the remainder? Right. So we got one remainder to distribute up there. Well, if we had one remainder, doing it under Texas law, per capita, with representation, one remainder, we would divide it into four shares. So each would get 1/4. A's 1/4 would go to R. B's 1/4 would go to S&T, each getting an 1/8. C and D would each get 1/4. With per capita at each generation, we would combine A and B shares. 1/4 plus 1/4 is 1/2, and divide 1/2 into three pieces is 1/6. And so R, S, and T would each get 1/6 of the remainder. Again, you know you do it. If you know you do it right, if when you're done with per capita at each generation, everybody equally related gets an equal share. So every kid has to get the same amount, and every grandkid has to get the same amount. Because that's what we're doing. Per capita, meaning everybody the same, but it's per generation. Did that help? Very good questions. Anything else? All right. Well, what I propose to do now is I think that you have worked hard. It is time for us to take about a 10-minute break. And here's what we're going to do. Take a 10-minute break. Get yourself organized. We still have some snacks left. Margaret doesn't want me to bring any home because then I might eat them. So she said take them for later. If you haven't signed up for door prizes, please do so. We'll do door prizes after the break and then get started on our Wills review. Yeah.